work. Whenever the person wasn't using their machine's processing power, SETI did. It worked very well. SETI ended up with one enormous processor in effect, able to solve problems just as fast as one of the supercomputers they couldn't afford. The coach nodded, blue eyes twinkling behind her glasses.
I think I see where you're headed with this, Doctor. You're using the SETI network to crunch the numbers on the Oracle's security that much faster.
Staffman shook his head. He was getting excited. He licked his lips.
No, I did better than that, Staffman said. The SETI network isn't strong enough to get through the Oracle's security. I had to use something else. I sent out a virus, something I designed a few years ago. I refined it a little bit to make use of flaws in Microsoft and Linux OSs. I decided not to hit Max, although I could have, believe me. Maybe I should have. They're about due to get knocked off their high horse.
The coach cleared her throat.
Right, Staffman said. Sorry. Anyway, my virus lets me access every system it infects and utilize some of its unused processing power. Most computers don't run at 100% of their operating capacity. Oh, they might for short periods of heavy activity, but most of the time it's down at 20% or less. That leaves me an enormous amount of computing power to access. The whole thing, tied together, is called a botnet. As of right now, the virus has gotten to about 3/4 of the world's systems in just under 72 hours. That's a record, in case you're wondering.
I wasn't, the coach said, her voice turning a bit frosty. What do you say you cut to the chase here, Professor? I'd appreciate it.
A botnet lets me crack the Oracle systems much more quickly. This bar, he indicated the third monitor, shows how we're doing. We've only been at it for about 24 hours, and we're nearly at 0.01%. That's remarkable progress for the level of encryption we're trying to break. It should have taken months.
Dr. Staffman, if I understand you right, it means we won't get this done for more than a year.
The twinkle had vanished from the coach's eyes.
Staffman swallowed. She had done some very quick math to come up with that figure. That absolutely correct figure.
Coach, you have to understand how incredible it is that we can do this at all. We're accelerating the procedure by 1,000 times. I know it's slow, but it's the only way.
I need it faster. I need it now, Staffman.
It can't be done. I'm already using 1/4 of the world's computing power as it is. What do you expect me to do?
The coach raised one dark eyebrow. Staffman wondered if she dyed them. Her hair was a uniform silver gray.
Why are you only using 1/4?
Let me explain the situation, coach. Look at this map, Staffman said, gesturing to the central monitor on his desk. I'm having my team monitor the processing power my botnet is sucking up, to make sure that it doesn't get too heavy in any one area. If we're going to be in this for the long haul, we have to stay below the radar.
But you could use the rest if you wanted to, the coach said, her tone thoughtful.
Yes, I suppose, but look, I might not be explaining myself very well. If I turn up the usage, then the virus would be noticed. People would take action. We'd have to stop.
But if you used it all, then you could get past the Oracle's security that much faster. It wouldn't matter if someone found us. We'd already be in, the coach said.
Staffman was beginning to get frustrated. He'd paid his dues in grad school as a teaching assistant. Explaining concepts to laymen was never pleasant, and the worst were those with a little knowledge, enough to think they could second-guess him. The only problem was that he couldn't exactly give the coach a D-.
The thing is, though, he said, trying valiantly to keep any trace of sarcasm out of his voice. The computer processing power we'd be stealing is being used for things right now. Air traffic, the internet, military. And not just here, but all over the world. The entire globe would go haywire, coach.
But you could do it.
Staffman ran a hand through his hair. He adjusted his glasses. He looked across the room, to the window at the back. He let his gaze rest there for a moment, then shifted his eyes back to the coach.
"Yes, I could do it," he said. "How much would it speed things up?" "Exponentially. I could have your answer in a matter of hours." "So do it." "Coach, I can't. People would die."
The coach perched on the edge of Staffman's desk. The scientist unconsciously leaned back in his desk chair, as far away from the woman as he could.
"Dr. Staffman, listen to me. You aren't a good person. You know it and I know it. You're selfish and you're cowardly. That's all right. It's not like you're unique. Most people I've met are just like you." "And so," she continued, "I think we also both know there's no way you'll give up your life to save the lives of a bunch of people who may die when you fulfill your duty as a member of my team. You don't know any of those people. The truth is, the only person you give two shits about is yourself. So save your life. Save me the bullshit. And do it. Now."
Staffman stared at the coach. He thought about the money he had been promised as payment for successfully breaking through the site's security. Almost a decade ago, he had done another job for her, and the money from that effort had funded his own research for years. Years without groveling before university tenure boards. And worse, teaching cow-eyed, dull-minded, disinterested undergraduates. That money was almost gone.
"Okay, coach," he said. "Good," she said, her voice cold. "Get on with it."
Staffman cleared his throat.
"Stop monitoring the nodes," he called to the rest of the technical team. "Shut down your workstations and leave. I'll contact you if I need anything else."
A chorus of questions and complaints arose in the room. People wanted to know if they were getting paid what they were promised, why the project had stopped. Staffman's mouth tightened.
"Just get out," he shouted. "You'll get your money. Just go."
No one moved.
"Now, doctor, that's not the way you handle a situation like this," the coach said.
She slid off Staffman's desk, getting carefully to her feet.
"People, you'll all be taken care of. You have my word. Now get on out of here and enjoy yourselves. Hell, you've just been given the rest of this beautiful spring day off. What are you still doing inside? Go throw a frisbee or ask someone on a date. You'll like it, I promise."
She chuckled. The technicians looked at one another uncertainly.
"Go on now," the coach repeated, more firmly.
A tech near the door shrugged. She hit the switch on her computer and powered it down. The rest of the team followed suit. Within a few minutes, the room was empty.
"You need to learn to handle people, Dr. Staffman," the coach said. "You catch more bees with honey, as the saying goes."
"Right, coach," Staffman said absently. His hands fluttered across his keyboard, preparing to increase the draw from the botnet. It didn't take long.
"It's ready," he said. "Just hit the enter key and it will start." "No, Professor, you started up. You made the decision to do this. You need to take responsibility."
Staffman gritted his teeth. He extended his index finger and tapped his keyboard. On the map of the globe, red plague spots began to appear in the midst of the green, expanding quickly, like bloody welts on the surface of the world. Immediately the progress bar on the third monitor began to speed up, clicking through the 1% mark in just under a minute. Staffman watched, awed.
"How long will it take?" "I didn't think it would be so fast. The virus must have infected more computers than I realized. It's amazing."
He watched, mesmerized, while his creation did its work. The botnet chewed its way through the world, behaving exactly as designed. Pride filled his chest. The coach stood next to Staffman's chair,
hands on her hips, peering through her glasses at the monitors.
Say, she said thoughtfully.
Yes, coach.
Something occurs to me. The way you explained it, your virus will take over damn near every computer system in the world, so they can't do what they're supposed to do. They'll be working on our little Oracle problem instead.
Yes, coach, Staffman thought. The sky is blue. Yes, coach, 2 + 2 = 4.
Well, she continued, turning to look directly at Staffman, doesn't that include the power grid?
Staffman stared at the coach for a moment. He lunged back to his keyboard and began to type furiously.
Your face just went like a slaughterhouse cow after it gets hit with the air hammer. So I guess that answers my question, the coach said. How will all those machines keep going on our project when the lights go out?
Staffman didn't look at her, just continued to type.
Come on, he muttered. Boy, you've got an answer for me.
Staffman bit back the withering response that leapt to the front of his mind. I built some degree of control into the botnet, coach, he said, not taking his eyes from his screens, his fingers flying.
I can give it commands, explain that it needs to keep the power on, but it's not easy. It's just a piece of code. It's smart, but it's stupid. It doesn't remember what I've told it to do, so I have to keep pulling it back from power nodes over and over again. It's like putting out a forest fire by dumping glasses of water on it one by one.
The room fell silent except for the rattling of the keys.
Will that work? The coach asked.
Does it sound like it will work? Staffman snapped. I'll keep it going for as long as I can. We'll lose parts of the grid for sure, but hopefully I can maintain enough processing power to crack the Oracle's security before we lose too many machines.
The coach rested a hand on Staffman's shoulder, its psychological weight all out of proportion to its physical weight.
Listen, son. If there's anyone who can do this, it's you. I wouldn't have put you on my team if you couldn't do 10 improbable things before breakfast, as Lewis Carroll put it. I'll let you work, but just know I've got all the faith in the world in you.
Despite his personal distaste for the woman, despite knowing that the coach had threatened his life not 10 minutes ago, Staffman felt a blush of motivation flow through him. The lady had a gift. That's all there was to it.
Wait and see, coach, he said. We'll have him.
Chapter 23.
It's a bad idea, Will, Hamza said. That's all I'm saying.
It's all you've been saying for 3 days, Will answered. How about you just let it go?
The light changed and they crossed Lafayette. Hamza watched, frustrated, as Will stopped and peered along the street.
Was it on Great Jones? Will asked.
I don't know,
Hamza said. Look it up. I've been to this place before. I know it's around here. Let's go this way, and if we don't see it in a block or two, I'll check it on my phone. Or you could just look it up now.
Will shot him a glance.
What's your problem tonight, Hamza? He said.
My problem is not tonight. My problem is long-standing and eternal. My problem is this. It makes no sense to give our whole goddamn game away to some stupid website. I mean, Christ, Will, if we had to do this, at least we could have gotten it on TV, or the New York Times or something.
Will rounded on Hamza.
TV? Every stupid talking head on every news show takes potshots at me. And all those televangelists preaching that I'm the devil. That fucker Branson and all his cronies, with their Detectives for Christ bullshit.
Easy, Hamza said. Branson's almost mellow compared to some of the stuff coming from people overseas, Will went on, his eyes tight.
They're talking about declaring, shit, what the hell is it? The Salman Rushdie thing.
A fatwa, Hamza said. I did notice that, actually. You've got both Sunni and Shiite leaders united on that point. That's impressive. Get a rabbi on board and the Oracle might just get peace going in the Middle East.
Hilarious, Will said, a sharp edge to his tone.
Hamza held up a hand, palm out.
Peace. Listen, I'm just saying,
You don't have to do an interview, he said. You could post something about the Oracle's intentions up on the site.
The site's the problem, Will answered. The only real contact anyone has with the Oracle is a bunch of words on a computer screen. When I was down in Florida talking to the ladies about the Oracle, they were terrified. And they work for us. We kept the site up once we figured out that the predictions were connecting so we could speak to the world if we needed to. Use its influence in a positive direction. But if everyone's just getting more and more frightened, how's that going to work? We need to turn that around. I want a chance for people to see that I'm nothing to be scared of. That I'm a person, not some freak. That's not even the main part, either. We need to tell people about what the site's doing. Having more brains on it just makes sense. I almost think we have to do that. This is bigger than us. It always was. Will, if you tell the world about all the terrible things that are happening because of the site, hell, even if you do it anonymously, they'll blame the guy who put it up. You and I know you didn't create the predictions, they aren't yours, but the world won't make that distinction. They'll blame the Oracle. They'll blame you.
Maybe that doesn't matter, Will said. Maybe telling people about all this is more important.
Hamza shoved his hands in his pockets and gave Will a direct look. They stared at each other, standing on the cold East Village sidewalk.
What? Will shouted, finally.
I'm just trying to protect you, Hamza said. And I'm trying to protect myself and Miko and our kid. Just...
He trailed off, watching Will's face, hoping to see some sign of agreement. Understanding, even. He'd take what he could get.
Okay, Will said finally. I'm sorry. I mean it. You're right. I wasn't thinking straight. All of this, it's just so heavy. The idea of setting it down, letting someone else handle it. It sounded really good for a while.
Hamza took a deep breath, then released it slowly.
Okay. I'm not trying to be a dick, Will. I'm just trying to figure all of this out. I just think that should be the priority. We can put this together, I know it.
Yeah, Will answered, turning and walking up the street toward the corner. That's why we're down here tonight, isn't it? And tell you what, if we learn something tonight that cracks the case, then I'll cancel the interview.
Wait, what? Hamza said. You're still going to do it? But you just said...
I'll do it. I just won't talk about what the site's doing. I think I need to get out there. Change some minds about the Oracle. Let them know I'm not a monster. I need this, Hamza. I know we can do it safely. You'll make sure.
Hamza kicked at a piece of trash on the sidewalk, trying to decide if it was worth pushing back, visualizing Will in front of a reporter and feeling panic rising along his spine.
No, let it go for now. Take the half victory and see what tomorrow might bring. Or tonight, even.
After all, there was a chance this whole Aberdeen thing could actually pan out. Maybe they'd break it wide open, figure out what the site was doing. If they could just find the damn bar.
Will pointed up the block.
Look, there it is. McAvoy's.
Halfway up the block, several clusters of people in identical dark coats stood smoking outside a bar with two huge bay windows that projected slightly over the sidewalk. A sign hanging above the door swung in the wind, a wood panel carved with an overflowing pint glass and the name of the bar. The smokers all wore small, round, white caps. As Will and Hamza drew closer, they could make out a dark stripe around the crown of the hats, and could see that their jackets were classic navy peacoats.
See, Will said. Those sure look like sailors to me.
Hey, I would never doubt the Oracle, Hamza said. I just questioned your intimate familiarity with the location of the sailor bar.
They stopped across the street from McAvoy's. The sailors were now producing a chorus of low, raucous laughter.
You're sure they're the ones we want? Hamza said.
Only one way to find out, Will answered.
Hamza watched as Will crossed the street and approached the group. He said something, Hamza couldn't quite make it out, and as one, the sailors' heads swiveled to look at him.
They seemed amiable enough, but somehow still projected an undercurrent of chaos, like they were just killing time waiting for their evening to truly start, full of shouted imprecations, smashed bottles, and smashed heads. The conversation seemed to draw to a close, and Will turned around and crossed the street to rejoin Hamza.
"Did you get the sense that you almost got your ass kicked there?" Hamza said. "Because I did. I'm sure it was just those guys. Smokers, you know. The ones inside will be friendlier," Will said.
"That makes zero sense," Hamza said. "Are they at least from the right ship?"
"Yeah," Will said. "HMS Aberdeen.
They wouldn't tell me anything else, and I didn't want to push it."
"Aw, man," Hamza said. "There's no way this doesn't end with us both getting punched in the face."
"We have to try. This is the first time we've seen a ripple hit New York since we started working on the site's plan. This is a chance to get ahead of it for once. We might never get another opportunity like this."
Hamza looked across the street at the bar, a spiked ball of nerves spinning in his stomach, counterbalanced by the fact that he knew Will was right. McAvoy's was a dark-paneled enclave with all but a few square inches of wall space covered with photographs and framed newspaper articles from various points in the bar's 150-year history. The space was narrow up front by the bar, but widened in the back to a room with a few thickly constructed tables and chairs. Both sections were packed nearly wall-to-wall with men in dark blue uniforms, women to whom they were paying a great deal of attention, and pints. Will and Hamza fought their way through the crowd and found a spot in a corner near the back.
"Okay, game plan?" Hamza said.
"Well, we know that the Aberdeen wasn't due to dock in New York for months," Will said. "It's supposed to be part of that big NATO war game exercise in the North Atlantic, according to the articles we read. But it's not there, it's here. And we know that's because of ripples from the site. The connections are pretty clear."
"Clear is relative when it comes to this stuff," Hamza said. "But for the sake of the argument, sure."
"So it has to be one of two things," Will continued. "Either the site wants the Aberdeen here, or the site doesn't want it wherever it was originally supposed to go, once the war games ended. What we really need to know is the ship's mission. Until we figure that out, we don't know what the site is trying to accomplish."
Hamza scanned the room.
"And even if we do, then what? Stop it? I hate to bring this up, but it didn't work very well with the lucky corner."
Will frowned.
"This isn't like that. We aren't trying to stop a prediction. We're trying to handle a ripple."
"You think that makes a difference?"
Will shrugged.
"Better idea?"
"Okay," Hamza said. "Go ahead. But I'll stay back here. I've got your back if you need it, but I sure as hell hope you don't."
"Thanks, pal," Will said as he looked over the bar. "You know, this would have been easier if we'd brought Miko along. She could probably get these guys to tell her their social security numbers."
Hamza raised an eyebrow. "Or the British equivalent," Will added.
"Maybe so," Hamza said. "But I have a policy of not sending my wife off to flirt with drunken sailors. Actually, what makes you think they'll talk to you at all? Last time I checked, you're a dude."
"I have a plan, sort of," Will said. "A good opening line, anyway."
Hamza watched as Will stepped toward a table with an empty seat, whose occupants were talking quietly, relative to the rest of the room anyway, enjoying their drinks without getting too crazy about it.
"Hey, fellas," Will said.
The table fell silent.
"Buy you gents around?"
The sailors stared at Will. One finally spoke.
"Being honest, mate, you aren't exactly our type. Well, most of us, anyway," he continued, clapping one of his colleagues on his shoulder. "Maybe Freddy here'd give you a second look."
Freddy took a long, slow sip from his beer and looked Will up and down.
"Nah," he said. "I prefer redheads."
A chorus of good fellowship erupted from the table. From his corner, Hamza watched with some relief as Will sat down and summoned a waitress. Hamza glanced around, looking for a men's room. Spying a sign at the back of the bar, he made his way through the crowd and waited in line for a urinal that, when he arrived at it, looked exactly as he expected it would after being well used by a succession of sailors. Hamza finished and ran his hands under the tap. The only nod to hand drying was a cloth ring towel running through a metal box that supposedly sanitized it. He wouldn't trust something like that under the best of circumstances, and sure as hell not in McAvoy's when the Aberdeen was in town. Wiping his hands on his pants, Hamza had a hand on the door back to the bar when he heard shouting, angry voices rising above the rest of the cacophony. He slowly pushed the door open, fairly certain he knew what he was about to see. Pushing through the packed ranks outside the men's room, Hamza came upon a little circle of cleared space around the table Will had chosen. Everyone at that table, including Will, was on his feet. One of the sailors had the front of Will's shirt gathered in one hand, and an empty bottle gripped by the neck in the other.
"What the fuck you playing at?"
the sailor shouted, his face red, spittle visibly striking Will's face.
"Nothing, man, listen," Will began.
"I ain't your fucking man, you fucking yank. What in the good goddamn makes you think it's any of your bloody business asking about my ship's mission?"
"I was just curious," Will said.
"Just curious, he says," the sailor said. "You know what they did to the fucking cat, don't ya?"
Phenomenal, Hamza thought. He shoved through the front ranks and stepped up to the sailor holding Will.
"Hey now," Hamza said. "No need for that. Let's all just settle down. Let me buy a few more rounds. Hell, let me get one for the bar."
Sporadic cheers went up at that, but the sailor holding Will wasn't having it. He rotated his head slowly, staring at Hamza with bulging eyes.
"So here's this poof's little packy friend then," he said,
addressing the other sailors at his table. Hamza felt his entire body go cold.
"What did you just call me?"
"I called you a packy. Why don't you sort off and get me a kebab, boy? I've got some business here with your friend."
Hamza took a step back.
"Listen, you racist son of a bitch. You let my friend go, right now, or I'll rip your goddamn balls off. And then I'll put you through that wall right there."
"Ooh," the sailor said. "I'm supposed to believe some little 10-stone nothing's going to keep me from doing whatever I bloody well feel like doing."
Hamza clenched his jaw.
"It doesn't matter if you believe it or not. I'm going to do it anyway. You've got 3 seconds. One..."
The sailor grinned at Hamza, revealing teeth that were fairly white and straight, defying expectations.
"Two," Hamza said.
The sailor smashed his bottle on the table, leaving a jagged, ugly-looking stub clenched in his fist.
"Three,"
the sailor finished, his grin widening.
Chapter 24.
"Someone else get on," Lee Shore thought. "Please."
4 floors intervened between the cubicle farm housing the writers, art teams, and assorted other low-level employees, and the floor containing the executive offices. 4 chances for the elevator to pause, the doors to open, someone to get on, and the doors to close again. 5 or 6 seconds each time. Even one stop would be something. But no. The elevator rose smoothly, bringing her closer to unemployment with each passing moment. She wished she'd been able to go out on her own terms, quit in a blaze of glory, maybe. She'd never actually been fired before. 5 minutes before, Lee had been in the conference room with the rest of the office, watching coverage of the ongoing American military efforts to liberate Niger from the insidious grasp of Prophet Idris Yusuf. Actually, that had supposedly already happened. The president claimed that the prophet had been killed in a precision drone strike a few weeks before, but no one had told the prophet's soldiers. They had continued fighting, even ramping up their efforts, and had taken control of a place she hadn't even known existed until the news started to cover it. Niamey, the capital. U.S. forces had expanded their bombing campaign, but there was only so much an aerial campaign could accomplish. The Prophet's forces had entwined themselves with the local populations, forcing them to remain in the cities and villages to act as human shields. It was becoming increasingly clear that either ground troops would need to go in to clear out the capital, or the United States would have to cut its losses, declare victory, and leave the people of Niger to figure out their future for themselves. Watching the footage, Lee was horrified to realize that she was almost bored watching the familiar sight of U.S. warplanes pulverizing a desert country's infrastructure into sand. Then Reimer's assistant had appeared and dragged her out of the conference room, telling her she needed to be up in Johannes's office immediately. None of her colleagues, even Eddie, would meet her eyes as she got up to leave. She was finally done. She'd pushed too hard. That's all it could be. And honestly, she'd be lying if she said she hadn't seen it coming. Reimer was furious when she'd skipped out on her scheduled interview to film the Oracle riot. She'd gotten an extremely expensive camera damaged, the company had to cover Eddie's medical bills, and while she'd managed to retrieve the footage he'd shot, none of it was particularly newsworthy. All in all, a nightmare of wasted time and money for Urbanity.com. Lee hadn't stepped out of line since, but evidently Reimer had just been letting her twist in the wind. Time was up. The elevator doors opened. Lee stepped out and made her way across the executive floor to Reimer's office. The door was open. She knocked on it anyway. Her boss looked up. "Ms. Shore," he said, "come in, and please close the door behind you." Lee closed the door and stood in front of Reimer's desk. He gestured for her to sit. As she did, she noticed that his tie was a bit loose, and the top button of his dress shirt was undone. For Johannes Reimer, that was on the same level as anyone else running through Central Park wearing a glitter-studded thong. He was fiddling with a sheet of paper on his desk. A printed email, maybe. Lee frantically thought back over every piece of communication that had left her computer since she'd started working at Urbanity.com, trying to remember if she'd ever written anything inappropriate, resulting in a flood of correspondence she would rather die than see on her boss's desk washing through her mind. "Miss Shore," Reimer began, not looking at her, then stopped. He picked up a pencil on his desk and tapped it against the paper a few times. "Will you read this and tell me what it means to you?" With the eraser end of the pencil, he pushed the paper toward Lee, rotating it so that it faced her. She reluctantly picked it up. It was, in fact, an email, but she hadn't written it. "Your proposal is accepted. The Oracle will meet with an interviewer from Urbanity. However, there is one condition. The person to conduct the interview must be Lee Shore. If this is satisfactory, instructions for conducting the interview and depositing the non-refundable fee will be sent to you. Respond within 24 hours. Her heart began to pound. She read the email 3 more times. I don't understand, she managed.
"You don't know why you are mentioned specifically?"
"No, I don't. Honestly. What's going on?" Reimer sighed heavily.
"You know about the email address on the site? For questions to the Oracle?"
Lee nodded. "I think everyone does, Mr. Reimer," she said.
"I sent in a question."
In the little corner of Lee's mind not consumed by whatever the hell the email might mean, she wondered what Johannes Reimer could possibly want to know about his future, and more importantly, if he was actually about to share that with her. Poking around in other people's Oracle questions had become a sort of taboo subject in polite society, like talking money or politics. You told your closest friends, maybe, but that was about it.
"I asked him if he would do an interview for our site."
Lee's heart, already revving pretty hard, jumped up a few gears. Reimer frowned heavily.
"I never thought he would answer. I mean, he doesn't answer anyone, right? We'd have heard about it. So asking for an interview, it was a lark, I guess. Just part of feeling connected."
Lee had never seen Reimer with an expression anywhere near the one he was currently wearing. He looked lost, afraid even.
"I got the Oracle's email yesterday afternoon," he said. "I spent last night considering what the hell I was going to do. I didn't sleep."
What? Why? Lee blurted out. You said yes, right? I mean, this is the best thing that could ever happen for this place. And me, too. I'm not pretending it's not. Why wouldn't you just go for it?
Because I proposed an interview fee of $10 million, Reimer answered. Lee's eyes widened. That's the operating budget for this business for the next 4 years, Ms. Shore. I chose $10 million because I thought it was probably half what other outlets had to be offering. I never thought it would happen. It was a safe bet, just something to let me feel like I was in the game.
Reimer rubbed a hand across his forehead.
And then he called my bluff.
So fucking what? Lee said. It doesn't matter what it costs. There's no bigger thing than this. This is the biggest thing.
Shock rippled across Reimer's face, then anger.
Lee didn't care. The Oracle wanted her, and there was no way she was letting that slip away.
Look, I'm tempted, Reimer said, wrestling himself back under control. The Oracle's the most famous person on the planet. An interview with him would pay for itself almost instantly. We film it, license it out, maybe do a documentary even. It's not really the money. The problem, he continued, taking the email printout back from Lee, is you.
Lee felt her eyes narrow. She knew she was getting angrier than she probably should, but she couldn't help herself.
She opened her mouth to speak, but Reimer held up a hand for silence.
You're a junior reporter on what's basically the gossip beat for a fourth-rate website, he said. Why you and only you? It makes no sense.
He looked her directly in the eye.
Do you know the Oracle? Reimer said. Personally, I mean. I thought maybe it was some sort of plan between you two, but that made no sense. But if not that, then what? Why does he want you, Ms. Shore?
Lee smiled. You got me, Mr. Reimer. Maybe he wants a reporter with a little vision. Maybe he read that goddamn great story I posted about him on Urbanity last year. The one you wanted to kill.
Do you really think right now is the time to bring all of that up? Reimer said, real anger emerging behind his voice.
Actually, yes. You haven't recognized my skills since I got here. I've paid my dues on shit assignment after shit assignment for absolutely no recognition. Every time I come to you with a proposal that could elevate your stupid site into something approaching, you know, good, you send me back down to my cubicle with a spanking. And now, you've got the chance of a lifetime, Johannes, but you can't get it without me. Nothing at all happens without me. You probably think it's terrible, really burns you up.
Lee folded her arms and smiled.
I, however, kind of dig it.
Reimer stood up from his desk and planted both fists on it.
Lee, I'm trying to decide if I should spend $10 million here. Do you really think reminding me of the fact that you tend to do whatever the hell you want helps your case?
You're not deciding, Lee said. You already decided. If you hadn't, then you never would have called me up here, and you sure as hell wouldn't have shown me that email.
Reimer sat down heavily. He pulled an immaculate white handkerchief from his pocket and patted at his forehead.
So what next? He said. The demands?
Lee's face softened. Her anger dissipated slightly.
Obviously. But it won't be that bad. First, I want a promotion to lead correspondent. You'd want to do that anyway. When we do our piece on the Oracle interview, it would look a little strange if you sent out someone junior.
Reimer nodded. Sure.
Including the salary bump benefits the whole deal.
I already said yes. What else?
Lee thought for a minute. She really only had one other demand that mattered, but this wasn't the kind of opportunity you let slip by. She considered, thinking of other things to request.
I want my own office, no more cube, and a parking space downstairs.
Reimer nodded again, more slowly. She could almost see the calculations spinning behind his eyes. Guess I'll have to buy myself a car, she thought. One more, Johannes, and you'll like it. It's free. This story, no matter where it goes, it's mine. I don't just want to do the interview. I want the byline. I want final edit. And I do any follow-up pieces.
Impossible, Reimer said flatly. You aren't ready.
You have no idea what I'm capable of, Johannes. Besides, you don't have a choice. The Oracle asked for me. If you want this interview, those are my terms. And I'll want it in writing.
Reimer slumped visibly. He opened a drawer in his desk and pulled out a small silver flask. The smell of juniper berries wafted into the air when he opened it and took a sip. He didn't offer any to Lee, which she didn't mind at all. He took a long, deep, shuddering breath, then looked at Lee, seeming more in control of himself.
Fine. All good. Done.
Lee endured a surge of nervous elation so intense that it left her feeling hollowed out, like a spent Roman candle. She felt her face stretch into a wide, unhinged smile.
Look, I know you're happy, Ms. Shore, Reimer said.
He seemed exhausted, like he'd suddenly realized he was completely unprepared for the life he found himself living.
You won. Congratulations. But please at least think about what you've won. I think most people would stay 1,000 miles away from anything like this. I sure as hell would.
Reimer cast a glance at his flask, then back to Lee.
I almost deleted the Oracle's email the second I got it. I mean, what do we actually know about him? Or her? Or it? Nothing. Nothing at all. Except that the Oracle can apparently do magic and doesn't want anyone to know who he is. Doesn't that scare you? Because it scares me.
Reimer stood up and held out his hand.
If I'd known he would answer, I'd never have asked, he said.
Lee took the offered hand. They shook.
Too late now, she said.
The lights went out. Lee dropped Reimer's hand, looking up at the ceiling in confusion. The darkness was complete, which was unsettling. It was never dark in New York. There was always someone else's window, a neon sign, a late-night restaurant that leaked its illumination into your sightline. But now, nothing. Lee released Reimer's hand and walked carefully across the office to the big window behind his desk. He had already turned to look out at the city, and she took up a position beside him. It took her a moment to understand what she was seeing. No lights in the windows of the building across the street. Lee craned her neck to look up and down Third Avenue. Other than the lights of cars on the streets below, no signs of electricity in any direction. Somewhere downtown, a siren began to wail. Chapter 25 McAvoy's was dark. Sounds of confusion filled the bar, accompanied by a few alcohol-soaked, derisive boos.
What's this, then?
The sailor holding Will's shirt said. His grip slackened slightly. Will took the opportunity and wrenched himself backward. His shirt came free and he grabbed Hamza's coat sleeve.
Come on, he shouted.
They slipped toward the front of the bar. Splinters of light from car headlights came in through the big plate-glass windows, supplemented by people holding lighters and cell phones over their heads. A delay as they pushed their way through the knot of people shoving their way outside. They ran to the corner. Will glanced back, but it didn't look like anyone had decided to follow them. He slowed to a stop, panting, feeling his heart throb.
I think we're okay, he said.
Hamza leaned against the side of the nearest building, catching his breath. He held up a hand in acknowledgement. Will looked up the avenue. People had spilled out of every bar and restaurant and were goggling up at the city gone dark all around them, their breath steaming in the cold April air.
What's going on? Hamza said.
Blackout, Will answered.
I can see that. I wonder if it's the whole city. Did the Oracle see this coming?
Nope, Will said. Surprised me as much as it did you.
Hamza tried his cell phone.
No signal, he said.
Weird. The phones still work down here when Sandy shut the power off below 14th. The towers are on a separate grid from the rest of the city's power.
Maybe they changed it since then. Who were you trying to call, Miko?
Yeah, I'm sure she's fine. We have tons of candles, batteries, all that. Just want to let her know I'm okay.
Will looked up, and for the first time he could remember, saw stars in the city's sky.
What are the chances the trains are running?
No chance, Hamza answered.
Will said. You know, there had to be people on the subway when this happened. Down in the tunnels.
Hamza shuddered. An aproned man stepped out of a nearby bar and set down a sign with a message chalked on it, letting passers-by know that the taps were still flowing, but it was cash only until the lights came back on. Will gestured at the sign, giving Hamza a questioning look.
No, man, I just want to get home, Hamza said.
Will nodded.
Yeah, all right. Probably for the best, he said.
He looked uptown.
I guess we're walking.
I guess we are.
Figures, Hamza said.
Stupid sailors had to pick a bar way the hell down in the village. No way in hell we'll find a free cab. Not tonight. I've got like 50 blocks to walk, and it can't be much over 30 degrees out.
Could be worse. You could live on 94th.
Yeah, Hamza said. That would suck.
Will shot him a look.
I'm just playing around, Hamza said. Come back to my place. Sleep on the fold-out tonight.
You sure?
Miko won't mind, Will said.
Don't be an idiot, Hamza said.
All right, good, Will said. I'll take you up on that. Feels like a weird night to be solo.
I'm sure the lights will be back on in an hour, but, you know.
I do.
They headed north, hunching their shoulders against the cold. After a few minutes, Will spoke.
Thanks for trying to help back there.
You sort of did a crap job, but thank you.
Just pray life never puts me in that situation again, Hamza said.
I don't like being forced to hurt people.
Uh-huh.
Did you actually get anything from those guys before they decided to kill you? What did you say to get them so riled up?
I asked them if they were in New York for some kind of leave, and they said no. They were supposed to be carrying a bunch of soldiers from a base in Northern Ireland to somewhere in Asia. One of the stands, I think. It was hard to understand them. They were Welsh. But then their boat got diverted, and they put in here instead.
Huh, Hamza said, considering.
That's about it. I tried to ask them what the soldiers were going to do over there, and that's when it fell apart. I guess I pushed too hard.
I guess so. So what we get from that is this. Either the site doesn't want soldiers in that stand, or does want them here.
But why?
I have no idea.
And so here we are, out in the cold, having learned essentially nothing. Great night out, Will. And so I suppose you still want to do that interview.
Suppose so.
But I'll stick to what I said. No crowdsourcing.
It's a start, Hamza said.
They trudged along Lafayette Street in silence for a few moments, both taking in how dark the streets were, even with the lights from traffic.
You know, Hamza said, the walk uptown will take us through Union Square. I don't think I've been back there since the riot.
Me neither, Will said, his voice tight.
You remember that woman who interviewed us for a minute that day? The hot one?
Will stopped. He turned his head, meeting Hamza's eyes.
Yeah, he said.
Will looked away.
Thought so, Hamza said. I looked her up, Lee Shore. I don't even know why you told me her name. You didn't think I'd look her up?
Why her, Will?
I've read her work. She's actually written about the Oracle before, and she's good.
Maybe I thought I'd give the interview to someone who could actually use the break. Will said.
Or maybe it's because she wasn't afraid.
You saw her, man. Even when those riots started, She wanted to rush right in.
If I'm going to do this, I want to talk to someone who isn't afraid.
Uh-huh. Whatever you tell yourself, just remember that she's seen you before. She's talked to you. You don't think she could make the connection? I know you want to do this in disguise, but still, it just seems...
What does it seem like?
What? Will said, shouting. It seems like... You're walking into traffic again, Hamza said, his voice quiet.
Will looked out at the dark city, the streets lit only by headlights, shadows trudging along the sidewalks, sirens from every direction.
Maybe I am, he said.
He put his hand on Hamza's shoulder.
Guess you'll have to make sure I don't get hit.
He turned and walked north, Hamza following a moment later. 50 blocks and 23 flights of stairs later, Will pulled open the thick steel fire door leading out to Hamza's floor. He paused to look back down the stairwell, where flashlight beams sliced through the pitch black, weaving through the shadows. Snatches of echoed conversation bounced off the concrete walls. Out in the hall, Hamza pulled his keys from his pocket and inserted them in the lock. The handle turned before he had a chance to touch it, and the door opened, pulling the key ring out of his hand. Miko stood framed in the doorway by candlelight spilling out from the apartment, wearing a long coat.
Oh, thank God,
she said, and immediately wrapped her arms around Hamza.
Hey, it's okay, Hamza said, stroking her hair. It's just a blackout.
Will looked away. This seemed very much a husband-wife moment. Miko let Hamza go, sniffling slightly and laughing at herself.
Not really, she said. Hey, Will.
Hey, Miko.
Will's going to crash here, if that's okay, Hamza said.
Of course, Miko said. Come in, both of you. The stove's gas, it still works. I made coffee.
They entered the apartment, pleasantly illuminated by 20 or 30 candles in all sorts of holders. Candelabras, glasses, empty jam jars. Will and Hamza unbuttoned their coats but kept them on. It wasn't anywhere near as cold inside as it was on the street, but the building had a modern central heating system. It didn't work without power, and the warmth they had generated by walking up 20-plus floors was rapidly dissipating.
What did you mean when you said, not really, Miko? Hamza said.
Huh?
Miko said.
At the door. I said it was just a blackout, and you said, not really.
Miko tilted her head, puzzled.
You didn't hear?
Hear what? I've been walking for the last hour.
Turn on the radio. I was listening to it until you guys showed up.
Hamza flipped the switch on a battery-powered radio on the coffee table. Immediately a news station came on through faint static. Hamza walked into the kitchen and came out a moment later with 2 coffee mugs, handing one to Will. They listened as the radio announcer described the scope of the blackout. Will looked at Miko.
This is... I know, Miko said. It's not just here. Power's out all over the world.
Silence.
Do you think the site did it? Miko asked.
Will didn't answer. The radio announcer solemnly proclaimed that he would continue to broadcast updates as he received them, as long as he had gasoline for the generator powering the station's transmitter. He then proceeded to describe disasters occurring all over the world as power and computer systems failed.
Look at that, Hamza said.
He had turned to look out through his apartment's large windows across the East River, toward the dark shadows of Brooklyn and Queens. Will and Miko turned to follow his gaze. A finger of flame rose up from the darkness, spreading out into a cloud as it grew.
What is it?
Miko asked.
Tanker truck, maybe, Will said. Propane or something.
As the light from the initial explosion faded into a dull glow, new blossoms of flame appeared to replace it, rising up all across the darkness beyond the river.
Tarakul.
The lights of the city of Uth radiated in the deep night, reflections off the stillness of the Aral Sea creating a sort of mirror city in the water, shimmering and inconstant. Six men sat cross-legged around a fire on a hilltop overlooking the city, sharing skewers of shashlik, passing the spits of fire-blackened mutton between them. Skins of kumis circulated as well, some of the first of the spring, as the mares produced milk for the new foals. One set of lights in the city of Uth shone from a higher perch than the rest, a Byzantine cross projecting from the exact center of the dome atop what had once been a mosque built 5 centuries before. But for more than 2 decades, the cross, an insult, blazing out across the plain. One of the men, the leader of this group, turned his gaze toward the city, looking at the defiled mosque, then back at his men. He said nothing. There was nothing to be said. Another man tossed his skewer into the dirt, scowling at his chief. The leader held the other man's gaze for a few moments, then reached over and picked up the discarded skewer from the ground. He dusted off the worst of the dirt and took a bite, washing it down with a long swig from his skin. The chief considered. He thought about the power he held, the men he could gather to his cause on a word, and more importantly, the sword of God hidden away in its canyon. He thought about what it would mean to pull his army together, and what it would mean if he lost. Timing. As with so many things, it was all in the timing. Without warning, the cross atop the mosque in Uth winked out, along with all the other electric lights in the city. If not for the firelight still twinkling here and there between the buildings, it would have been easy to assume the city had been wiped off the face of the earth. The chief and his band got to their feet. Brownouts were nothing strange in Uth, but normally only a portion of the city would go dark at a time. This suggested a larger failure, and perhaps an opportunity. The mere city off the coast was gone, swallowed up into the black water. The chief watched the dark city for a moment, then lifted his head and shouted up at the stars, crying war. Chapter 26. Staffman's hands ached, a tendon's deep pain that ran halfway up his forearms. He wanted nothing more than to stop typing, to soak his hands in hot water and pour half a bottle of ibuprofen down his throat. But each time he pulled his fingers off the keys, his botnet shut down another portion of the worldwide power grid. Each failure meant that many fewer computers available to work on breaking into the Oracle systems. And that much longer he'd have to keep his agonizing fingers moving to try to keep the virus contained. He flicked his eyes to the right, to the screen with the progress bar. 99% and counting. It had taken nearly 4 hours to chew through the Oracle's security. Despite Staffman's efforts, the world map on his monitor was more than half black, with the rest an angry red, dull like the coals of a fire that had almost burned itself out. The entire American East Coast was dark, as was all of South America, Australia, and parts of Africa. He'd managed to maintain a good deal of Asia, the United States, and Europe, with their heavy concentrations of computing power. Losing Africa was frustrating but survivable. San Francisco alone held more processors than that entire continent. The coach sat to Staffman's left. Neither had spoken much in the last little while. For the first few hours of watching Staffman work, she had offered what assistance she could, getting him a glass of water, although the 10 seconds he'd taken to drink it had put the lights out in Brazil, or reminding him of all the freedom he'd enjoy with the money he'd earn by finding the Oracle's name. But after a while, she just sat back to watch the battle. New consequences of the virus's release kept appearing in the forefront of Staffman's mind, no matter how hard he tried to focus on his work. Research projects in the midst of crucial calculations that would have to be restarted from scratch, costing God only knew how much money and time. Critical surgery was almost always computer-assisted these days,